RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
I'm at the home and studio of the illustrator and writer Sarah Fanelli. Her world consists of fantastic monsters and eccentric characters of her own invention. For over a decade, she has been sharing this world with children and adults alike through an array of illustrated books that have earned her a worldwide reputation as one of the most distinctive and idiosyncratic picture book creators. Born in Florence, Italy, she came to London in the 1980s to pursue her desire to illustrate and attended the City and Guilds Art School, Camberwell College of Art, and then finally the Royal College of Art. She has won many international awards and commendations for her work and has just recently been made an honorary Royal Designer for Industry, the first female illustrator to be honored by the faculty in its entire 70-year history. Sarah, I want to start by, I think, for the people listening, I want to describe this room. We're in your studio in North London, and the thing that I like about both designers and illustrators is that no matter where they live, they always create a really interesting sense of place. And this is no exception, because it's filled with what many people might think was clutter, but to me it's fantastically stimulating. You've got, on the top shelf of your book, you've got lots of tins, metal toys, pieces of three-dimensional typography, little children's... I have to put my glasses on to see, but it's just an array of items that you've no doubt collected, I guess, from travels and various shops and junk shops. You've got pots and ceramics and dried flowers, and below that you've got more toys and then lots of books. And in the centre of the room you've got your work table, which is cluttered with pieces of what look like collections from the local park, leaves and branches and lots of rough pieces of cut-out paper. And there's another table to write, which is in a similar state. So the room is really overly loaded with lots of clutter, which is, I guess, it's your engine room for where you work and create. So I think, you know, that set the scene. We're in your studio in London where you work every day. So I wanted to start really by asking you, why, having been born in Florence, which in its own right is entrenched with art history and is very beautiful, why you decided to come to London for your art education, which you presumably had to fund as well, which is, you know, an expensive thing to have to do. So what was your reasoning for that?
Yeah, when I was in Florence, I studied... I didn't go to an art high school. It was more about literature and language. And so although I've always drawn and I always enjoyed painting and drawing, I really felt that I had to spend some time figuring out which part of all the avenues or all the art world I would like to follow. And a friend of mine told me about foundation courses in England. I'd never heard about such a thing. And it seemed to be making sense of having a course of just 1 year where I could try different techniques and different approaches. So that was the original idea, the foundation course, and the fact that it was only on offer in London, well, in the UK, and then it made sense to come to London. And then just discovering how wonderful the art colleges were here, and very, very much the focus on experimenting and trying to find your own voice, while in Italy the equivalent, there wouldn't quite be an equivalent to art colleges in design and illustration at the time when I would have done it. Now it's more set up and structured, even in state university, but when I grew up in Italy it was only a couple of private colleges in Milan and or very few places you could do not fine art. So to me was incredibly, even just the fact that you called your tutors by their first name and not by their surname, this openness and this sharing towards finding each of you your own path. It's so different from in Italy.
And that was in the mid-80s that you...
It was, my foundation course was 89.
Well, before we get onto that, which we will later, I want to sort of go back for a moment to Italy, and I want to to talk about the young Sara Fanelli, and you know what kind of child you were. Were you a naturally creative child? Were your parents creative? Did you have influences around you? I mean, how did this kind of passion for drawing and this eclectic thing that you have that's very evident in your work, how did that come about?
Yeah, no, I was very lucky because my parents, they exposed me, my mother more directly, my father more indirectly, to a lot of art through books and also visiting museums and churches that are full of wonderful works in Italy and abroad. And so I must say, yes, it was definitely encouraged, and I was very lucky in that sense to be exposed. One of my very strong memories is of being a child and sneaking to my parents' bed and looking at the spines of books and names of people that I now know who they are, but they were very, very strange name, like Otto Wagner or Adolf Loos, and just I remember the Loos, L-O-O-S, the two O's. It was a very nice type, very simple on the spine, and then slowly the curiosity of looking what is inside that book, not just the spine, and how it went with the one next to it.
And did you draw a lot? Did the drawing ability sort of start fairly young?
I have a sister, so we both probably were encouraged to draw, but I seem to enjoy it more. And I remember when I was little, particularly making three-dimensional things, a bit like you were mentioning you used to do. And then also trying to make books. At first with my sister as a journal, as a family journal, but it never worked out. And then instead making just very, very simple books. But there's always a connection, I guess, with books there, because I started by saying the books we were surrounded by, even before the art we saw. And then immediately I think of drawing, but I also think of making things and making books. And then I also used to, when you have to do commitments of studying and school, I carried on just doing the drawing because it was something that was encouraged, but also something that gave a nice time and space on my own relationship between the object and just the quietness of line. And it, I think partly because I didn't go to a art, we call it liceo artistico, it made it even more of something that I love, because it was never something I had to do as a homework, or it was more the treat after the homework.
And your parents, were they in any way in creative fields or not at all?
Yes, no, that's why they had the books and they showed. And my mum is very much interested in the history of textiles. Uh-huh. And she did research in that, and then she taught art history at high school.
Ah, okay.
And my dad, he teaches history of architecture at the university there, and he also had various researches, some in medieval Florence and some more about 19th century and 20th century architecture and graphics. So that was
so
very
that was
lucky.
A very healthy atmosphere for any child that had a sort of visual sensibility, if you had that around you.
Yeah, healthy, at least from the artistic point
of
view,
being,
yes.
And being in Florence, of course,
yes,
which is
true.
Which in itself is fantastic. Healthy. I mean, I heard a really, really horrible fact the other day on the radio, which I don't know whether you heard it, and they are now saying that children in the West are spending on average up to 6 hours a day sitting in front of their computers playing computer games, which is
6 hours.
That's I found that difficult to believe. But
even just to think of 6 hours of free time.
And that's, I mean, it seems to me that whilst computers brought us, you know, lots of wonderful things, for children to be doing that now and not actually be experiencing just being outside or looking at things or just being curious, being locked into a world that's sort of dictating to them, seems to be a great tragedy. You know, and listening to what you have just said about your childhood and being surrounded by books and being inspired by your parents is something that sadly doesn't seem to happen as much these days.
But also the fact of watching a screen, for however stimulating, is always a bidimensional experience. And some, for pre-childhood up till maybe this generation, you would connect with the smell of different seasons and also with trying by mistake, making marks by mistake, or not even making marks, but just making a mess by using, I don't know, I used to really like playing with talcum powder and water and trying to, because the talcum powder tries to stay on top of the yes. water, or mixing water with earth, and it had the same sound as the hot chocolate. When my grandmother used to make hot chocolate, it had the spoon against the grain of the chocolate. It was the same as, and all those things that then also helped the spatial, you know, playing with paper or all those games with simple pieces of wood. It's more of a three-dimensional approach. So I can't imagine how those children, also using your hands is so lovely.
Yes. And I mean, the fact of the matter is that your area of work is a very traditional pursuit for the child. It's, you know, pictorial storybooks aimed more or less, although many adults obviously appreciate books, they are very much aimed at children, it would seem to me, and certainly my children who've read, you know, several of them, because I've had them all, I can see how they respond. And I think particularly, I noticed in your books, looking at your earlier books as well, I think your first book was Button.
Yes.
Book, and the second one, the Map book.
Yeah.
Which struck me because it seemed that you built into your books very early on this idea of participation.
Yeah.
That you wanted the reader not just to read the book and the story, but you wanted them to be involved in some way and create something to be part of the process. And so in the, for example, the Map book, the whole cover opens out and you, on the reverse side, you have your own space to create your own map of whatever it is. And in that book, you've mapped out your life, you know, it right down to a map of your heart, which I thought was a very touching thing to do. And it just struck me that, you know, having that kind of thought to ensure that the reader is involved in some way, it's very unusual, because I haven't seen many books like that, and you seem to have done it from the very beginning. So what I was going to ask you is that did the writing of these stories come first, or the illustration? How did the two kind of come together, or was it a natural process from, I mean, you talked just now about being a child and keeping a little journal, so you've always liked the idea of telling little stories and illustrating them, or how did it sort of crystallize? From, I'm thinking more, you had your foundation course here, and then you went on to do a degree course, and then you later went to the Royal College, of course. So tell me about the progress from the foundation course, how you discovered your feet and a direction, and how it evolved into what you're now doing. How did that process sort of come about? Did you have a grand plan, or?
No, absolutely not. But I'll tell you about the Map book, which actually happened more or less at the time of towards the end of my BA. The reason why I was thinking back on Italy, because there's a lot of things that I have understood and I appreciated about where I come from by not being there. And at that time, I was trying to, when you're at college, there's so many projects. And one of the things that was really important, and I was taught at Camberwell, was that an image should have a message. Well, some people, there's a space for everybody, and there's a sort of illustration that can be just a decoration. But I like, even for how little the message is, for an image to contain some message or some story or some thoughts inspiring, even small thoughts, kernel of an idea. And I was trying to, in a way, revisit my roots. It was only 3 years that I had left Italy, but still, that was my most recent experience. And I was drawing these maps, remembering my neighborhood and then my house. So it was this, maybe it was some kind of homesickness, or trying to remember what was peculiarly Italian about that upbringing compared to where I was then. And then I was also looking at Jean-Michel Basquiat's painting, and I really liked the roughness or the vitality and the directness of his marks and his colours. Mm. And so it links with the fact that when I started my BA after the foundation course, I was painting fairly flat colours with gouache. I mean, drawing has always been really important, and even now, although the drawing doesn't come always directly into the images, I do keep sketchbooks, and I particularly draw when I'm on holiday or travelling rather than holiday. And then, so at that time, trying to find different languages, looking at other artists and looking at Basquiat, I then wanted to marry these two things, the map, the memory, and the visual inspiration. And then in the end, when the book came about, actually in every spread, there's an element that has a dotted line where the child can put their own idea. So in the, for instance, the map of the heart, there's a little bit that says someone special, and everybody can write who it is. Or in the map of the tummy you can put your favorite food. And so to try to make the whole book almost, so that was my version, but then it could become the version of the child or the person who's got it. So I didn't want it to become too much, because I had that experience, but other people have different experiences. I wanted it to be more of an inspiration to then apply that way of thinking to the other person's experience. So that's about the interaction. And so that's why I dared calling it my map book, because then it would be mine. For everybody who has it.
Yes, I understand. I mean, interesting looking at that book, the map book, and looking at how your style has evolved. That early book was it seemed to be much more painterly.
Yeah.
Big, flat, bold colours. Very little collage in it at all. And when I look at the later books, you know, the monster book, particularly the that's got this fantastic combination of collage, and in particular it has this what seems to be a passion with hand lettering that you use yourself, but a lot of material that you've sourced from old ephemera, so it would be pieces of exercise books or ruled paper, which seems to give your work on one level a sort of a nostalgic feel, whilst being incredibly modern. So I wanted to ask you a little bit, and it's sort of because I think these elements that you find these old pieces of material gives it a sort of strange patina of age. It's an odd collaboration of things, and I just wanted to ask you a bit about how that came about, and what is your why have you got this fascination for these, you know, these copper plate lettering and marble papers and all of these different little elements that go in to make these pictures, which are, you know, give a very rich view of the world. I just wanted to.
Yeah, the papers. It's I think it's a combination of two things. One. The strongest one probably is the fact that I feel because they you can clearly from the marks they have or the colors or the age coloring, you can tell that these pieces belong to a different time, and therefore they bring their own story with them. There is a I like collage because you can interweave different layers, and even within the collage you can have different stories with the pieces. So in Mythological Monsters, when there's the spread of the Minotaur, and it takes place in ancient Greece, in fact in Crete, I looked through the collection of papers looking for some sandy, earthy color representing Greece, and then I found this very mottled old piece of paper, and the fact that it was mottled, it brought the history with itself of time and accidents and all these evocations, which to me enriching the collage. So one is the stories they bring in their own with time that they bring, and the other thing is probably the fact that I tend to like, maybe it was relating to my childhood, as you say now childhood is very different, but I like things where you can see marks and you can see something that is handmade, and those papers seem to have a little bit of imperfection, or to me it's even more perfect the fact that they were probably made with plates, metal plates, and so they're slightly embossed, and you can still see that handcrafted element. It just aesthetically appeals to me, and maybe it's because it's related to this thing of a society where you do play with objects and everything has a history and a story. So those are the reasons. Of course, there's also a sheer, well, both those things I said also go with a sheer aesthetic element they fit each other. Don't they? It's just justifying both ways.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the other thing about your work is that is very evident is that even though you might be termed an illustrator, for me, I think you're very much a designer, and I think your work is clearly designed, and you have total control over the whole thing, in that you, more often than not, unless it's something like the Pinocchio book, which is typeset in a traditional way, but with your own books, they all tend to be handwritten and planned, and they have this riot of different sort of lettering styles and emphasis and underlining and so forth. And so you must, how do you plan these books, you know, rather like a designer would plan layouts in the same way, as opposed to many traditional illustrators, they just produce the illustrations that drop into spaces for others to create the design around. But you're in control, it seems, from the cover right through to the very end.
Yes.
Is that something it seems to be from those early books, again, something you've done from the very beginning.
Yes, yeah, because I see the book as a whole, and I love typography, I love the shapes, I love the playfulness, or all the elements that you can use, and they seem to be make sense to use those in a picture as well. So it's very true, when I plan a page, I plan the elements of the design of the illustration, but equally at the same time, just as if it is another element of the illustration, applying where the type goes and what kind of weight it has in the balance of that composition. So it's all one. It's all at the same time.
And of course, the other thing, the other factor that sings your own is that you write your own books as well. I mean, was that also a kind of a plan from the very beginning that you wanted? Because I think have all of your books, apart from the occasional excursions using, you know, working with the classic material, you've written them all.
Yes, but they are very much picture books. They're very picture-led, and they're more, I don't consider myself a writer at all. It's more coming up with a story and a world for that story. And yes, they are fairly simple stories. Dear Diary is quite complicated, but again, it's more the idea of one day's event seen by seven different characters. But then, it's definitely still a picture book, although the writing, and that is the ultimate example, because it reproduces pages of a diary, so the handwriting is so vital. So in those pages, the weight and the importance of the text is so equal to that of the images, but I still consider it very much a picture book. So
do you find that one comes first? Are you always sort of thinking through possible storylines and then turning them into, you know, maybe something more pictorial, or is it a pictorial thing and then you had a story around the pictures?
Sort of. They each have a different genesis, the books. And I do try. I never think of the books in connection to the previous one. If anything, it's by contrast with the previous one, because they all feed different passions or different ideas or different researches at that time. And most of the time, I think if I try to balance out, it does. The story comes out of a visual idea. So maybe there's a drawing or an image that I came across in my personal research, or that keeps coming back, that I particularly enjoy at that time, and I decide I would like to write a story for this character or develop this image into a narrative. And that's why probably I end up doing the stories as well. It's not because I think I'm a fantastic writer, but because I can then create the stories exactly to what I want to draw and around the world I want to depict.
I mean, being a writer is not in a way dissimilar to being an illustrator, and you're both, in that it tends to be a fairly solitary business. You know, you tend to, most illustrators that I know over the years, work at home with the radio on, you know, the working way, or, you know, these days many of them work far away, and they literally send their work in via by scanning and sending their material directly to their publishers, or sending certainly all of the rough material. It used to be faxes, you know, before that sophisticated. But what's your kind of daily routine? How does the day start for you when you're working on a project?
Well, somehow, even if it's a personal project, there seems to be always something on. But I'm really bad in the morning. I get all this hope for the future. It's like the Saturday before the Sunday at 6 o'clock, all the potential of light seem to come on the horizon. So then I tend to work till late, which means I'm not very early bird. But if there's a project ongoing, then there is that wanting to carry on from where you left it last night and see where that day is, like a little bit of the journey on that path, where that day will bring you to. There's also, I mean, that's the ideal scenario when you have the time to do what you want. There's also all the interruptions of the phone calls and emails and practical things. So that's why, again, the end of the day or weekends, I find, is the best time to create properly, have the space.
Do you think that I've always felt with designers and illustrators, they kind of have this innate need to share things with people. You know, there's an excitement about sharing what you've done.
Yeah.
And it would seem to me that if you go through a long period of working alone on a project that you've sweated over and agonized over for, you know, months and months and months, and the social part of you is revealing it to the outside world and getting a response. I mean, do you get that kind of sense that you want to share this? If you feel it's going well and you're liking what you're seeing, that you then can't wait to get it out there and let people, you know, be exposed to it.
I'm quite critical of what I do, so it's fairly rare to have that. But when the book comes together, I think to finally see it, maybe if I see the proofs and then I see the fruit of that project, then yes, then I can't wait, for instance, for the book to be out. Usually you have to wait for another half a year, if not a year, between that stage. And that's true. But the feedback for which... with the book, usually is by bringing it in to the publisher. But I must say, with everything I do, it's really nice and it helps a lot when people make comments. And even this thing as the RDI, to me, it's one of those elements that make me think is worth carrying on doing what I do, because there is a sense of very much isolation and a lot of self-doubt. And even when you work for short-term commissions, people sometimes they forget to tell you that they liked something that you did, because they are so moving so fast. And it's not, you know, maybe they did really like it, but you'll then hear about it 3 years later and say, oh, you did that illustration that was so good. But they forget to tell you. And so this, if occasionally I get a letter from somebody that has seen a book, or also from... which is very warm to receive, but also from colleagues, like this occasion, it really does help a lot, because working in a void, it can make you feel a bit very insecure, especially when you keep, in order to carry on the inspiration, you keep looking at these wonderful, wonderful things that have been done, and then you try to think, is it worth my carrying on doing, trying to be as good as... Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think we should say that, you know, we're kind of on the verge of you becoming an honorary Royal Designer for Industry, which in itself is a remarkable honour. But more importantly, you will be the first woman in the entire 70-year history of the Faculty of Royal Designs who worked in the area of illustration. Never before have there, which I found staggering, but
yeah.
Checking back, there have been no female illustrators ever in the faculty. So that's an amazing thing.
Yeah, it's very surprising. It's an incredible honor to be the first one. I can only think it must be to do with the history of the faculty rather than...
Yes, yeah, because I know for a fact myself that, you know, throughout the 50s there were quite a lot of extremely
sure.
talented British female illustrators,
yeah.
you know, that I used to like a lot. Why they never got brought into the faculty, well, it's for the people that were part of that group at the time to answer, but it seems very odd to me.
Yeah.
I want to move on to another kind of area of your life, which seems to me to be quite important to you, and that's your involvement with promoting drawing and children. So, for example, I think you've been involved with some of the Quentin Blake initiatives, Drawing Power and The Big Draw. Have you been involved in those? Or if not, you have been involved with some Arts Council
yes.
projects
yes.
of a similar nature, where you're trying to encourage children to see things
yes.
through drawing, which seems to tally, or seems to dovetail into what Quentin has been doing for
yeah.
many years here. Tell me a little bit about that, what you've been doing.
Well, mainly it was in conjunction with the Magic Pencil, which was an exhibition of British contemporary illustration selected and curated by Quentin Blake and Andrea Rose at the British Council. And it travelled as an original exhibition with original artwork in about 6 countries in Europe. And then it travelled many, many hundreds of countries all over the world in a facsimile edition, where each illustrator, there were about 13 or 12 illustrators, and each of us had, as a facsimile version, I think 4 pictures. But that being much more easy to send abroad, it reached places that really gained a lot by having those images there. And I had the chance to travel sometimes with the exhibition, and I went, for instance, to Venezuela and India, Romania, and recently to Portugal, and did workshop with local children and also local illustrators, and those were both really fascinating. With the children, what I love is to see how easily and instinctively they work with collage, because I find that in England somehow collage is seen as a very European as opposed to English technique or method of working, and there's a certain fear about collage, especially from older generations, while children instinctively it's the easiest way, because there's no fear of holding a pen and comparing to an idea of a good drawing that they have in their mind, and so they can be attacking the material and using the scissors very bravely, in a way even more bravely than I do. And publishers would be sometimes I take photographs of these pictures to show the publishers to prove them that collage is very easy for children. So that was from that point of view. And with the illustrators, sometimes it was really touching to see what sort of community in the places where there isn't so much going on. The fact that every illustrator knew each other and that they were quite supportive of each other. I really, especially in Portugal recently and also in Venezuela, this sense of a community. And the level, I thought, was good. They were trying to look at the right things. And so those were refreshing. I mean, in India, it was very hard to have enough materials to work with. But whatever we did, there seemed to be such a thirst for it. That.
And it is, I mean, the thing that you know, I'm a great believer in children being able to pick up a pencil from, you know, as young as possible and draw and begin to understand that drawing is not just a vehicle to entertain yourself, but it's actually a fantastic form of communicating, because if you can draw, I've found, through my life. If you can draw, you can make communication very, very easily with people. Mm. And it's kind of like one of those magic things. If you're able to draw, people become mesmerized. You know, I know that drawing with little children is always fantastically rewarding because they look and they're staggered, you know. And often it's because their own parents have never picked up a pencil and have never shown what you could do with just a piece of white paper and a pen or magic marker, whatever it might be. And that seems to me to be very sad for children, you know, because it's such an inexpensive thing to do. There's no switching, plugging things in.
Yeah.
You can create a whole world, you know, a magical world, and children are just, there's a moment in their life when they're completely ready for that.
Yeah.
And I've always found that very rewarding, that sort of aspect. And it is such a pity. And that's why I think that all of these various schemes, the one that you've been talking about, the magic pencil and drawing power and big drawer, are all doing the same thing. They're all trying to make children aware of the world through drawing. That, you know, that's making them look around them, as opposed to looking in one direction, looking all around.
No, that's fantastic that these programs exist.
So, tell me, what can we expect from you next? I know you're working on a book at the moment, which is you're hard up against the deadline, which I know has been driving you mad. So what's that book going to be, and when do you think it's going to be published?
Well, this book, it's very close to my heart because it's the sort of work that it lies, in a way, behind everything else that has gone more. It's been published, so has been seen. And both for the short-term commissions and for the books, there's a certain everyday research or a path that I tend to follow, which is trying to move the content of my work and also the techniques in my work or the way I make marks. And so usually how it starts is by reading, or in the books I read, or maybe hear conversations, or somehow come across some idea that touches me, and then try to give a personal interpretation visually of that idea. And in doing so, sometimes I come across things that then become books, or sometimes I come across elements that turn up in the commissioned work. And in the end, I decided to collect all this work together, dividing it up by subject matter, and have this book. Therefore, it's not for children necessarily. It's just a collection of quotations that were the text that inspired the images. So at the moment, it's the process of collating the material and also filling in. Now that is because none of those images were thought for a specific book, but now as a collection, I need to balance it out. So it's a matter of doing the images that are missing to make it even, and also finding the quotations for the same reason. But that will be, I will be very pleased, because I really would like to see more illustrated books, not just for children, but for adults as well, and ideally novels. I illustrated 24 spreads for Calvino's Invisible Cities, and there's many pieces of literature that have inspired colleagues of mine that I know, and I think it's just one of those things that one would wish a very enlightened publisher would come along and try. There seemed to be a lot around in the 19th century. It was very common to have illustrated books for adults, and now it's extremely rare. So although this is not just one text, it's a collection of texts, I still hope that it might give an idea to publisher about this possibility. And then I would like to do more children's books next year. And ideally, I really would like to collaborate with theatre and maybe opera. Or
yes, I could see that. I could see that, because, I mean, in the studio that we're sitting in, when I came in earlier, there was this large three-dimensional monster in bright red with many wings and jagged edges to it and eyes stuck on. And I could see that immediately being scaled up to theatre size. And I think that would look fantastic. Just to end on, I wanted to ask you, because there may well be, you know, young students just starting out and listening who would very much like to pursue a career as illustrators, and it's a very, very tough marketplace. There are many, many illustrators, I know that, over the years. Do you have any advice to any of them that might be wondering how you really sort of, you know, get there? Do you have any thoughts?
I think a couple of things. One is the advice that I was given that I find most important for me, which is always try to carry on exploring and looking for new things, because otherwise you end up not being interested in the work anymore. And that's fundamental for your own life. But the other one is to really persist, that if you believe in what you do and if you have passion, that you will find people that will see something in what you do as well. And sometimes when you leave college, you go and see so many places and you drop off your portfolio and you meet people and art directors, and you think that nothing is going to come back, but maybe eventually it will, and if you persist long enough, things will come back. So mainly to have passion and believe in what they do.
That's a good note to end on. Sarah Fennelly, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.